Hello, and welcome back to Spooky Shenanigans, your podcast for all things spooky, creepy, and downright strange. My name is Snell, and joining me, of course, is our resident skeptic of all things spooky, PJ.
Hello.
And in today's episode, we are going to be covering the... Let's just call it the true life tale of American Horror Story Asylum, because that's basically what it is. Wouldn't you agree, PJ?
I would, yeah. But I'd also like to point out that when the listeners hear what it's about, you've actually finally found an episode to pretty much call your own, just based on the name of the person that we're covering today. If this is definitely your episode now.
Thank you very much.
I don't mean the content, you know, no. Where she ended up, but
no. But yes, the name does make me giggle a little bit. So today, listeners, we are delving into the story of Nellie Bly, who was hands down probably one of the most incredible women I've ever heard of in history. She was a fierce feminist, I'd say, and one of the first, I'd say, probably women's rights activists.
Yeah, she's in probably like the US, American Emmeline Pankhurst, really.
Yeah. And her story is pretty much, it's pretty mind-blowing, I'd say.
Literally as well as metaphorically.
So, PJ, before I dive into all of the rich history and info behind her story, why don't you kind of give us a bit of an idea of what you know about it?
Okay, yeah, no worries. Listeners, if you are new to the podcast, this is the part where I give the true and accurate facts.
Yes, dear. Anything you say, dear.
This is the problem with this episode. It's not about ghosts or demons. It's just downright strange and chilling. Unnerving, yeah, chilling, I'd yeah.
Say. So, word for it.
Yeah, and if you are familiar with the Ryan Murphy show American Horror Story, in particular the Asylum season, which I think was season two, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, one of my favourites. Anything Asylum related, it just always gets me. I've probably in one in my past life.
I will explain a few things.
Absolutely. But it's such a chilling one. So, you know, my perception of this is that Nellie Bly, as you said, was a true feminist of her day. Was, and like I mentioned, probably the American version of Emmeline Pankhurst, sort of 50 years before she was even, I won't say a thing, but a movement, a person, you know, a figurehead of feminist history. Mm-hmm. And she was born in the mid, sort of, well, it was either the early or mid 1800s. She was born as Elizabeth, but her friends and family would know her as Pink, because even from a young age, she was quite the rebel and would dress in quite flamboyant clothing. Which at the time was very scandalous. You can't possibly wear anything other than dark colours and shades.
Absolutely not.
How dare you Shocking. Have a personality?
Shocking.
And sort of she grew up with her siblings, and they, being male, got to have all the fun jobs, you know, pharmacists, bankers, that sort of thing. And poor old, I was going to say Lizzie, I've read she hated being called that. Poor old Elizabeth got to be a cleaner and, look after kids. So, and she was highly educated. you know, which again is quite unusual at that time for women. But, you know, there's a reason she became the figurehead she was. She, you know, she was sort of destined to be this amazing person from an early age. And she ended up getting into sort of investigative journalism. I think thanks to an article she read, which you'll probably go into a bit more detail now, which, to put it bluntly, pissed her off. I mean, I would be pissed off as well if I read an article like that. I'm pretty sure you were, Nell, as someone who is part of that gender group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, nothing worse than someone mansplaining something to you.
Oh, God. They all need to get in the good damn sea.
It's all right. They're dead now. It's 150 years ago. They're gone. Not that there are any men nowadays that are like that. I can think of one that's been arrested in Romania recently. See you later. And she delved into a few interesting cases. Now, at the time, I mean, investigative journalism wasn't anything new. But, you know, it was all done by fellas, obviously. So for a woman to do something like this was, wow, crazy, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was unheard of.
It was, which is, you know, why it got so much publicity in the end. And again, we'll talk about that later. But effectively, she, well, wanted to do an article on what it'd be like to be an immigrant coming to the United States. And her editor at the time, who actually, I think she ended up working for Pulitzer, you know, the guy who created the Pulitzer Prize. But they suggested that she actually infiltrate makes it sound like an MI6 agent. Sorry, CIA, it's America. Infiltrate a asylum on Blackwell Island, which if you're from New York or know the area, you'll know that it's now called Roosevelt Island. But there was an asylum there, or, well, that's what you called them then. I don't know what they're called now, mental health facilities. To write an expose, and what she experienced in the 10 days that she was there, just horrific. And of course, you know, in American Horror Story, it makes it sound the, you know, Sarah Paulson character. I think she was in there for years. So I thought Nellie Bly would have been in there for years as well. But 10 days was enough. And I think she mentioned that that would have sent anybody, even sane, over the edge in that time. And some of the poor women that were in there, they had been there for a good part of their lives. All I can describe that, and I'm putting air italics or whatever they're called, air speech marks.
Air quotes.
Right now. Yeah, air speech marks, right. The bunny ears. The cures that they were called were just nothing short of torture, in my opinion. But after she had that expose published, her name became a household name. And ta-da, Ryan Murphy turned her into a lovely Netflix show. the end.
But not forgetting, of course, everyone to stay with us, Creative Lifestyle.
Nell and I have been speaking about merchandise for this show, and Creative License is going on a t-shirt. We say Absolutely. It every single episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how accurate was I there? Now, what would you add? What's your perception?
Well, I may as well just, you know, throw all my notes out the window. You've pretty much done my job for me, so thank you very much.
Well, thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you next week. I'm really brushing up. I'm a good student. This is what I mean. When there are facts, it's easy to talk about.
All right. You just wait. You just wait till the upcoming episodes. All right, mister. Okay, so Nellie Bly was born Elizabeth Jane Cochran on the May 5th, 1864. And she was the 13th of 15 children.
What?
Yep. 15, born to Michael Cochran and his wife, His second wife, Mary Jane.
What, all 15 came from Mary?
No. So he'd married twice. He had 10 children with his first wife, Catherine Murphy, and 5 more children, including Nellie or Elizabeth, with his second wife, Mary Jane Kennedy.
Both deserve a medal for that. Wow.
Right? Oh my God. I cannot even imagine. Well, I do not want to imagine.
No.
Jeez.
The complications that they both of them could have gone through, especially in that time, you know.
Absolutely,
surviving childbirth was, that was a hit and miss back in those days.
Very, very much so.
God, scary.
So Michael would end up dying in 1870 when Elizabeth was 6 years old. And this kind of brought the family basically into poverty, because obviously at that kind of time, you know, it was the men who were responsible for, you know, looking after the family and providing for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was really, really hard for women to make any kind of career for themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm. Awful.
And regardless of this, Nellie actually had a really, really good upbringing. And she, at age 15, would go on to study to become, or she had views of becoming a teacher. Unfortunately, a year into her study, she had to, unfortunately, pull out because basically she was just unable to afford to keep paying the costs, which
sad.
It is. It really, really is.
That is a big. Yeah, I'm trying not to go off on a rant right now, but it's one of my biggest bugbears in life. Is, you know, social mobility and access to education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you shouldn't ever be restricted from studying based on what's in your bank account or your family's. No. You know,
it shouldn't.
No, that's sad.
No.
Good job she was a motivated lady, wasn't it?
Otherwise, absolutely, yes.
She's been cleaning pots for the rest of her life.
So, in her kind of late teens, as you've already touched upon, she read a particular article in the paper. And it was basically titled "What Girls Are Good For," which was, according to the author who penned this lovely article, were principally for birthing children and keeping house.
What a lovely man.
Right? Just the kind of person you want to meet in a dark alley. just 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes. That's what I'd need. Apparently, Nellie felt the same kind of way because she would then go on to write a response under the pseudonym Lonely Orphan Girl, which basically really chewed this guy out and told him, you know, oh, really? Really? And yeah, just basically gave quite the public bashing, which in, you know, recent news brings to mind a certain, as you've recently mentioned, mansplainer and young women.
Yeah, it's not much has changed in 150 years.
Sadly not.
No.
However, the editor of this paper, George Madden, was actually so impressed with the passion in which she wrote. He actually ran an advertisement asking the author to identify herself so, you know, he could meet her.
Yeah.
So she goes along to the offices And he offers her the opportunity to write a piece for the newspaper, again, under the pseudonym, because, you know, it's pretty much unheard of for women to write anything at this time.
Yeah.
And the first article that she writes is was titled The Girl Puzzle.
Okay. And
this basically argued that not all women, you know, would marry and would want to marry, and that what was that she needed were, you know, better jobs for women. So right from the get-go, she's, you know, a full advocate for women's rights, you know, not just at home, but also in the workplace as well.
Yeah.
Her second article called Mad Marriages, which I love it, was about how divorce affects women. And yeah. She actually argued for the reform of divorce laws in this one. So,
oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, think about it, how awful it would have been back then for them. You know, they're kind of trapped. You can't go to work, and you can't build up your own savings pot. If the guy was a meathead who liked to drink and beat her around, then, you know, she'd been stuck in that for her life, however short that might have been with the bloke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just no protection. I suppose if they did divorce, the man would take everything and she'd probably end up in a workhouse.
Or worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, death is probably a relief back then from life. Didn't seem very nice.
Well, no, it
didn't have money.
So, one article that she writes actually kind of got her into a bit of bother. So she basically wrote for the Pittsburgh Dispatch on the lives of working women, more particularly investigative articles on women factory workers.
Yeah.
Now, at this time, obviously, you know, as you may know, listeners, working life in factories was not a pleasant experience for anyone, but particularly not before women who were like the primary workers of the factories. And so, you know, she was writing to kind of create more of an awareness of the bad, like, environments. And so the paper soon received complaints from factory owners about it. And in the end, she was reassigned to women's pages to cover, you know, the nice feminine articles like fashion and
party
and, you know, gardening and, you know, more ladylike subjects.
Yes. Things that are meant for the fairer sex, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
Don't be bothering yourself with the man's world, little lady. God.
Don't bother your pretty little head about that.
Yeah.
You know, let the men work that out. I mean,
I could feel your blood boiling from here.
Isn't that obvious? So, understandably, after a while, she becomes pretty dissatisfied, for want of a better word, for writing about these kind of subjects. And in the end, she would leave for New York City. And
the Big Apple.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, for the first kind of 4 months or so, she would face rejection after rejection, because news editors just didn't want to consider hiring a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after 4 months of this, she would talk her way into the offices of Joseph Pulitzer. The New York World, and he offers her the chance to basically feign insanity and go undercover to investigate the reports of brutality and neglect at the Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell's Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a pretty risky because, you know, for one thing, these places were really, really feared for a very damn good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, he had no, like, he had no way of promising that he could even get her out.
Yeah, that was going to be my point. You're going to put a lot of trust into a fella that you've literally just met.
Yeah. Just.
Oh.
It kind of blows your mind, really, doesn't it?
It does, because they have got some, well, or they did. They may have similar powers now. They're just disguised better. But back then, it was sort of a, no, once you're in there, you're not going out unless the asylum governor ticks it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it was Nelly herself who described, like, asylums being rat traps in the fact that it's easy to get in, but pretty much impossible to get out. So
definitely got away with words, yeah.
Had. So either way, she agrees to do this because she has absolute balls of steel, as far as I'm concerned.
Bigger balls than all the other investigative journalists. I wouldn't have done it.
God, no. Can you imagine?
No. They'd definitely keep me there.
Well, you know, I didn't want to say anything, but...
You'd be in the room next to me, Missy.
Yeah, you're probably right. Just give me one of those nice white jackets that lets me hug myself. It'll be fine.
Because no one else wants to hug me.
All by myself.
Oh, that's a copyright strike.
Oh, no.
I also read as well that how she got herself into the asylum. Are you about to cover that? Or shall I say it?
Oh, be my guest.
Cool. So it was kind of funny, actually, because I read that she used to stand in front of the mirror for hours practicing... pulling faces, which would make her appear mad. And to get herself into the asylum, she took up a room in a boarding house, and would stare at the walls for hours, just staring into space, and also would act like everything scared her. So it kind of reminds me of, did you ever watch the Catherine Tate Show?
I didn't, I'm afraid, no.
Oh, you missed out on comedy gold. So there was this lady in there that the slightest sound, she would go, ah! She would just scream at. So you turn the like bedroom light on and she'd go, ah! It's like Piccadilly Circus in here, Brian. So she just gives me that idea that, you know, someone would open the door and she'd just scream, or what do you want for dinner? Oh God, that's too scary to think about. Just to be chucked in a lunatic asylum. I mean, that's how easy it was back then.
It was, absolutely.
You've got a list, haven't you, of reasons for admission?
I do, yes. And some of these are...
I could do a whole podcast on these. They're just... I'll shut up and leave you talk about them.
Okay, so obviously I'm not going to go through all of them because there are quite a few on the list.
Uh-huh.
But the main ones that kind of jumped out at me the most, that kind of made me giggle, were novel reading.
Yeah.
Because how dare any woman enjoy reading, am I right? asthma? Dropsy? Egotism? Well, that's the art window then. PJ.
I was going to say that's 90% of the TikTok community in the asylum.
Let me see. Grief, which is kind of sad. Self angst. laziness, jealousy and religion, hysteria, immoral life.
Fell from horse in war.
Fell from horse in the war, yeah.
Kicked in the head by a horse. You'd need an actual hospital, never mind an asylum.
Right.
These are mad. Bad company.
Bad company, yeah. And something that actually kind of made me a bit sad, but sadly happened, is desertion of husband. So basically, if the husband had no interest in being with his wife anymore, he could just have her committed to an asylum.
Yeah. I've seen that in many films and TV shows, and it's
I mean, horrid. Look at Jane Eyre, where what's his name had his first wife locked in the attic for God knows how many years.
Yeah, it's awful. Because women weren't people back in those days; they were property.
They were property, yeah, they were
awful.
So, like I said, it was incredibly easy to get in, like scarily easy to get in. And I've actually been having a read of the book that Nellie Bly actually bought out afterwards that talks about like her entire experience there.
Yeah.
And one thing that she said, and I quote from the book, is, "From the moment I entered the insane ward on the island, I made no attempt to keep up the assumed role of insanity. I talked and acted just as I do in normal life. Yet, strange to say, the more sanely I talked and acted, the crazier I was thought to be by all, except one physician whose kindness and gentle ways I shall not soon forget."
Oh.
So
There was a good egg in there then.
There was a good egg. Unfortunately, probably one of the only good eggs.
Yeah.
In terms of actual, you know, staffing.
Yeah.
There. And it wasn't just women who were, you know, seen as, air quotes, problem women, or women who actually had, you know, troubles, but even like immigrants who, you know, had come across from somewhere else and who people couldn't really understand were put in there because, you know, well, we don't understand you, like, we don't want you here, so we're just going to shove you away and lock you up.
Wow.
Yeah. So one quote she made again from the book, and talking about the first night, kind of, I believe it was when she was waiting to go across to the island because she was held like on the mainland to be assessed by the doctors and physicians, and then once they deemed her air quotes insane, they then transferred her by boat to the island.
Oh, God. So, make it even more difficult to escape.
Absolutely, yeah.
Give me Shutter Island vibes.
You know, that is exactly the kind of vibe I got when I was researching this.
Yeah. And you know, the Americans love a good island. I mean, Alcatraz.
Alcatraz, yeah.
Can't think of any others.
So the quote I got from her first night there was, "Nearly all night long, I listened to a woman cry about the cold and beg the gods to let her die. Another one yelled, 'Murder!' at frequent intervals and 'Please!' at others until my flesh felt creepy."
Oh.
So, you know, there's no chance of a good night's rest there at all.
That would drive you mad.
Right?
Actually, I get so grumpy if I don't get...
Oh, you and me both.
Nice sleep.
I need my sleep.
Exactly. Yeah, because it might surprise you, listeners, but I am quite high energy, so I need my rest. So don't disturb my slumber. or I'll send Ghostus Interruptus after you.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll make an appearance this episode.
Well, actually, what was it that happened to us? That was it. I was looking for files. Yeah, listeners, so it happened again. So if you listen to the last episode, of course, it cut Nell and I off halfway through when we were getting into the juicy bits of Bobby Mackey's. And then today I was going through our files because, you know, I'm a very organised bean. And I couldn't find a couple of the episodes. I was like, Nell, what have we decided to do for episode 9 and 10? She's like, well, it's there on mine.
It's right there. Like,
I know.
Use your eyes, PJ. It's and there.
I went back on it and it was there. And I was like, I know. So yeah, Ghostus Interruptus. We've come up with the name for our mascot on the logo. He is now called, or they are now called Ghostus Interruptus because they're a ghost and they interrupt us. And it sounds so much better in Latin.
Doesn't it just?
It does. Anyway, what else happened to her?
Anyway, so whilst Nelly was locked up, she made a point of talking to as many women there as she could because, you know, she wanted to get reports from others who were there. And men and women were typically kept separate. So, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Obviously, she couldn't get any side from the men's side, but then I'd imagine that would typically be about the same as what the women were experiencing. So among the sane women, well, air quotes, sane, she found that many of them were actually immigrants who didn't understand English, as we mentioned previously, and seemed to have been mistakenly committed to the island, whereas others were just poor and thought that they were being sent to a poorhouse. So they were completely, you know, kind of misled. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. That's some chapters to us there.
No, it's still here.
Okay.
Listening intently.
Okay. So although Blackwell was originally built to hold something like 1,000 patients, they were cramming more than 1,600 people into the asylum when Nelly arrived in the fall of 1887.
Of course, the conditions would have been even worse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, extensive budget cuts had led to a sharp decline in patient care, leaving 16 doctors on staff. Now, 16 doctors to, like, 1,600 people. That's, for want of a better word, insane.
Yeah, that's a bit of quick math. That was, what, one doctor for every 100 people? Wow.
Yeah. But probably the most kind of disturbing of all, aside from, you know, the cold and the terrible food there, was the prevailing wisdom of the age regarding both the causes of mental health and how patients should be treated. Now, obviously, you know, thank goodness for the NHS today, because, you know, things are a lot better today than they were in this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, talking to her fellow inmates, Nelly quickly found out that, you know, they were frequently abused, both psychologically, physically, and often sexually as well. Yeah, so they were forced to take ice-cold baths and remain in wet clothes for hours, which obviously, you know, would lead to frequent illness, especially in the wintertime as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Apparently, they were forced to sit still on benches without speaking or moving for stints lasting 12 hours or more.
Wow.
Yeah. Some patients were tethered together with a rope and forced to pull carts around like mules. And on, and like I said previously, you know, the food and the sanitary conditions were absolutely horrific. You know, rotten meat, moldy stale bread, frequently contaminated water.
Well, it kind of sounds now, I'm a bit confused. I don't know whether we're talking about the asylum here now or the weekend I spent at Pontins.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but...
Now, any of our listeners who aren't British, Pontins is like a holiday park company here in the UK, which you go on holiday to. It's like a staycation, and it's probably one of the worst we've got here.
One of the most expensive as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like the Britannia Hotel Group. It's just absolute rubbish, but they still keep their prices high. I don't know how they're still in business. It's unreal.
I don't either. It's, yeah. Boggles the mind.
It does. So apart from sort of the conditions, and I mean, let's go through the sort of abuse that Nelly encountered then, because she was only there for 10 days, wasn't she?
Yes.
I mean, it felt like a lifetime to her.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
It would to anyone, I'm sure.
What was she experiencing there? Because I know you mentioned the cold baths and the...
Yeah, cold baths.
Being treated like a donkey.
Starvation was the big one as well. Like, they kind of believed that it was almost like kind of like purging the sickness out. Like, I can't even imagine, like...
These are supposed to be medically trained scientific people.
Mm-hmm.
I know what's good for your body. Starving it of necessary nutrients. Yeah, well done.
Yeah, it's...
They should have been in there. Never mind the patients.
They should have been. And that's the thing as well, is the fact that, from what I read, it was often difficult to tell the staffing and the inmates apart for the very simple reason that the staff didn't actually have, like, any kind of uniform.
Really?
No. So, you know, so obviously you see, you know, things in films where the inmates take over the asylum by pretending to be the staff or whatever.
Yeah.
But... in real life, yeah, it was often really difficult to tell them apart.
Oh, wow.
And that's quite scary.
It is. I mean, I can appreciate it for their personalities. But I find it a bit daft not to have some sort of uniform and to put the inmates in or the patients in a certain type of clothing as well. Because you tend to always see them in, not like, you know, the prison clothes, but... they've got some sort of gown.
Like starched white uniforms kind of thing.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So from what I read, getting my words out here.
Working your new teeth in.
Hey, how old do you think I am? Don't answer that.
Well, you knew Nellie Bly, didn't you?
Hardy, hardy, hard. So from what I read, the admission process for new patients were pretty dehumanising.
Yeah.
So patients were forced to strip down naked in front of the staff and be subjected to a public bath because it was seen as, like, you know, like cleanliness was next to godliness kind of thing.
But why in public? that doesn't make any sense, does
again,
it?
Again, for humiliation.
Yeah.
You know. Being searched and having their position searched, patients would be forced to submit to a physical examination and blood testing, including a syphilis test, which would actually be one of the, like, possible reasons why someone would get sent there.
Yeah, I saw that on the list.
So patients would also be subjected to interviews and mental tests, which Nellie Bly actually reported including being accused of taking drugs. So apparently, the doctor, when he kind of examined her first of all, noted that her pupils were quite enlarged because she was very nearsighted.
Yeah.
So he accused her of taking belladonna, which was, you know, basically a drug to get high.
Yeah.
So this was basically used against her for the goal of committing her in the first place. So two absolutely brutal methods that they used to air quote treat their prisoners.
No, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Included spinning and branding. So, what? Spinning treatment involved, like, literally strapping patients to large wheels that were rotated at high speeds, or suspending them from frame that would then be swung around. Why anyone would think that this would help mental illness, I'm not sure.
Spin out the body, that's it.
Yeah, something like, you know, kind of making them vomit as hell or something.
Step right up. We've got a great new activity for you at today's fair. Spin this patient. Get the badness out of him. You, sir, take a good spin. Mad. What the hell?
Yeah, and branding is, you know, exactly what it sounds like. You know, they'd be burned with hot irons. And that would be done with the belief that it would, like, bring them to their senses.
Oh, God.
Like they were literally branded like animals, like cattle.
Yeah. It's kind of coming across like they think that they're putting it on. And giving them that pain will make them go, "Ooh, I should stop doing it." You know, where children feign injury and cry for no reason, for attention.
Yeah.
Sounds like that.
Yeah, it does. And obviously, you know, we've already touched upon the physical abuse and the beatings that they would often be subjected to as well. And it'd be really sad because, you know, they would try to tell the doctors and, like, you know, make reports of, you know, of the abuse that the staff were committing them to.
Yeah.
And the doctors would just kind of brush it off as, oh, you know, that didn't really happen. You know, you're mad. That's why you're here, kind of thing. And then they would then get beaten more for reporting. So it was just a vicious cycle.
Yeah, stuck between a rock and a hard place there.
Yeah, they really were. And they were apparently drugged a lot to kind of try to make things, like, easier for the staff almost. So, you know, morphine was used a lot. But apparently the attendants seemed to take, like, almost pleasure and amusement in, like, you know, performing these inhumane acts.
Yeah, you tend to have a certain type of person that worked in these places back in the day.
Yeah,
I reckon they'd rank quite highly on the Robert Hare psychopathy checklist.
Yeah. I mean, taking a quote from Nellie Bly's book, yeah, take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up and make her sit from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on straight back benches. Do not allow her to talk or move during these hours. Give her bad food and harsh treatment and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck.
Wow.
Which... wouldn't it just?
Yeah, even if you went in there sane, you wouldn't stay sane for long.
No, you really, really wouldn't.
It's torture. What happened to Nellie in the end then?
So, luckily for her, after 10 days, the editor of the newspaper that she worked for were able to get lawyers in to free her.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So she was able to leave within 10 days, as, you know, they've kind of previously agreed. Well, you know, well, hopefully agreed to, tentatively agreed to.
I was going to say, do they have an agreement on the days she was going to spend in there? Because I can just imagine, it's like, you know, she goes in on Wednesday, then next Friday, like a week Friday happens, and the editor's sat there drinking his tea, and he looks around the office, and he's like, anybody know where Nelly is? Oh! Oops!
Am I forgetting something?
Who made my tea? There you go, a bit of a sexist joke for the day.
Just had to get that in there, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, they would have laughed at the time, wouldn't they?
So, the first articles on her experiences there were published within days, and, you know, this series became like an absolute sensation for everyone, because although in those kind of times, like, four of her very rich and wealthy, you know, going to have a tour around asylum was seen as, you know, like a pastime. But obviously, you know, these were guided tours, so they didn't see everything that was going on there.
Yeah.
You know? So this was a real eye-opener for everyone, you know, for the outside world, who would have like these kind of whisperings and rumors of these places, but actually had no idea what they were actually like. You know, something like this was absolutely shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing that, well, because of course she's a feminist, but this actually helps both sides, both genders, you know, in improving conditions. You know, and it's unusual for somebody to still be alive who inspired this sort of change, because, you know, what it's like, usually they turn into martyrs. You know, they've either been killed in the process, mm-hmm. You know, for things to be changed. You know, like that poor woman in the from the suffragettes who, did you see it, stood in front of the king's horse
at
Ascot. Oh, that is an awful video. Oh, it was horrific. You know, but they usually die in the cause, but of course she, within 10 days, you know, transformed a whole, well, entire system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so she brings up these articles within days of being released. And as I previously mentioned, she brought out a book about it as well. And about a month or so after these articles were published, a grand jury panel actually visited the asylum to, you know, actually do like a proper investigation of everything. Now, unfortunately, the hospital and the staff had been tipped off in advance. So by the time the jury members actually arrived, the asylum had actually, you know, kind of attempted to clear up its acts. And unfortunately, a lot of the inmates who had provided Nelly with the details of the treatment there had either been released or transferred. So there was no way of tracking them down to kind of verify this story.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not surprised. Covering their tracks. It's kind of like when Ofsted, now again, if you're not British, Ofsted is a governmental body that checks schools and educational establishments to make sure that they're up to standard. It's kind of like the auditing
side of things.
And it's always the same, like schools start going mad before Ofsted come to visit, and everything gets perfected and made right and in alignment with their codes and conducts. But it's kind of funny because the school I went to now, they actually did that.
Really?
Right. Yeah, well, they tried to. And they thought they pulled out all the stops to make it as perfect as possible. And my school was actually one of the worst in the UK, and they still failed after trying their best.
Oh, that's got to sting.
Yeah, that was awful, but there you go.
Yeah, I mean, listeners, for those of you who don't know, I actually work in childcare, so I am very well versed in the whole Ofsted thing. And let me tell you, nothing sparks more fear into the heart of any nursery worker, school teacher, anyone involved in, you know, childcare and education, then the word Ofsted.
And listeners, that's why Nell's good at dealing with me. She's used to dealing with kids.
I mean, it helps. But you got me back in, PJ. So, yeah, so by the time the jury members had arrived, you know, like, everything had been, like, scrubbed down as best they could, and the staff obviously denied all of the accusations and everything, and fresh food and water had been brought in, and, you know, they basically tried to make the place look as presentable as possible.
Yeah.
However, despite this effort, the grand jury actually still sided with Nelly Bly.
Oh, good.
And a bill was actually already under consideration at the time, and that was kind of pushed through. And that was increased funding for mental institutions, which added nearly $1 million.
Wow.
almost $24 million in today's money to the to like the right kind of departments that needed it the most.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So the abusive staff members were fired, translators were hired to assist immigrant patients, and changes were made to the system to help prevent those who didn't actually suffer from mental illness to be being committed.
Oh, good.
So, you know, for everything that she went through, Nelly Bly, she did so much good in...
Yeah.
In doing this. And honestly, you know, full disclosure, as someone who does suffer with mental illness and has done on and off for many years, and you know, has had loved ones, you know, have need support of mental health specialists, I for one am really, really thankful that we have the things in place for mental health that we do today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I cannot imagine the absolute fear that someone would go through in that kind of place in those times. Like, it's absolutely horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice as well that it's no longer a taboo topic to talk about now. There's a lot of support.
There is, and that's amazing.
It is. You know, it's, the brain is an incredibly complex machine.
Isn't it just?
It really is. And I remember, because I also have suffered from mental health condition, and it's, I just remember this workplace. Well, a place I worked before, and this is way back. And one of my managers said at the time, "Oh, just control it. You can just control it." You know. And I looked at it, and I just thought, you always know somebody that's not had the misfortune of experiencing it yet, because they say nonsense like that.
Yeah. I've been unlucky enough to have a deputy manager like that. I'm not gonna go through all of it, but no.
You manage it, you don't control it.
No. And that was something that she didn't seem to get.
So
we're kind of veering a little bit off topic here. So after the kind of sensation that Nelly Bly walked around with her kind of expose, she would actually go on to to a reel round the world in, I think it's something like 74 days.
Oh, yeah, she was trying to beat Jules Verne character, wasn't
yes,
she?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Which was really kind of cool, I have to say. And in, when was it? Let me see. Yes, in 1998, she was actually inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame.
Oh, perfect.
Which is really freaking cool.
That is, yeah. That is really cool.
She would pass away January 27th, 1922. She would die of pneumonia at St. Mark's Hospital in New York City, aged 57.
Oh, wow. She was so young still.
She was, yeah. Well, I mean, when she went into the asylum, she was like 23.
Yeah, I forgot. She was so young at the time.
Which is, yeah, it's very, very young. I mean, it's shockingly young.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Absolutely.
You know, the amount of good that she's done.
Mm-hmm. Undoubtedly.
Just mind-blowing. And like I said, this woman had balls of steel.
They were some big cajones.
Oh, yeah. Weren't they just?
balls of steel. If anyone's a Duke Nukem fan, you're a legend. You will get that reference.
So, listeners, that pretty much wraps up this episode today, I think, about the absolutely incredible work of Nellie Bly and the sheer bravery
mm-hmm.
that she had, like, to go into a place where, to be perfectly honest, she didn't even know for sure she'd come out of.
Exactly. She deserves a round of applause. Yes, Nellie. Woo!
If you've enjoyed the episode, then be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channels for any other dark, creepy, spooky stories that we both have. Mine is Nell's Crypt on YouTube, and PJ's is Serial Chillers. Next week we go into the story of, bear with me with the name because it's again a little bit of a tongue twister. Carolina Olsen.
Yeah.
Carolina Olsen. And you've heard of obviously the fairy tale of Sleeping Beauty. What about the real-life Sleeping Beauty?
Oh.
However, to hear more about this, we're going to have to tune in next week, dear listeners.
Exactly. So remember to follow the podcast.
So my name is Nell. With me is my lovely co-host, PJ. And you've been listening to Spooky Shenanigans, your podcast for all things spooky, creepy, and downright strange. Until next time, as always, stay spooky. Bye.
Bye.